You have to keep the mission and the goal in mind, which for me, the goal is to save the last of the wild tigers. I really want to see tigers exist for future generations. I have a new granddaughter. Her name is Winter Rose Ruggia. She's 9 months old, and I want her to live in a world where there's still beauty, where there still is healthy wildlife, where we still have functioning ecosystems. And that's why I do this work.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. Welcome to Species Unite, the podcast where we talk to people who are fighting some of the hardest fights on Earth to stop the unnecessary suffering of animals. Today's conversation is with Sharon Guinup. Sharon's a freelance journalist, an author, a National Geographic explorer, and a global fellow at the Wilson Center. She writes about wildlife and ecosystems with a focus on wildlife trafficking and conservation initiatives. She wrote the December story for National Geographic called The Tiger Next Door, which is all about the tiger problem happening right here in the USA. Before we even begin talking about your article that just came out in the December issue of National Geographic, The Tigers Next Door, I want to talk a little about you. And I know you've written about tigers in the wild and wildlife trafficking, but how did all this start?
I was a photographer from the age of 16 to 39, and then I went to graduate school and studied both science, environment, and journalism, and switched gears and started to write. As a writer, I followed my early childhood passion, loving animals, and my work has focused on the environment, pollution, wildlife, and eventually a lot of work on wildlife trafficking. Because if you're going to cover endangered species and going to look at the reasons that they're disappearing, one of the greatest threats beyond habitat loss is wildlife trafficking and poaching. So photographer Steve Winter and I have done a lot of work specifically on tigers over the past, 10 to 15 years, including a book for National Geographic called Tigers Forever.
Why tigers?
It just happened. Steve started working on big cats, and we often wanted to work together. We're a couple. And so we started doing work on jaguars, on snow leopards, and eventually tigers. And we've done a lot of work specifically on big cats. Someone contacted me a number of years ago, I think we believe it was 2015, and told me that they could prove that a venue in Thailand, the Thai Tiger Temple, which was a monastery that doubled as a tiger attraction in Thailand, was trafficking tigers into the illegal wildlife trade. And I worked with her for a year, and we did prove that they were doing exactly that.
I remember.
The public buried officials and government agencies in emails and letters and phone calls, and experts and nonprofits got involved, and the Thai government was placed under such pressure that 4 months later, the Tiger Temple closed down.
It's a huge victory.
That was my introduction to the captive tiger issue. And when I found out that there were more tigers in the United States than there are left in the wild, I decided that I had to look into that. I really wanted to find out what was happening when they were too big to pet.
Let's talk about your story. So before we go into it, though, for people who haven't read it, can you give a recap? I know it's not an easy recap because it's a very layered story.
This was a more than 2-year investigation into captive tigers in the United States. Few people realize that there's somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 tigers living in cages in the United States. There's only 4,000 left in the wild. And just for context, you have to take that 4,000 and divide it among the 5 subspecies. So there are more Bengals, in India and a couple of neighboring countries than anything else. That's about 3,000. So put that in context of what's here in the U.S. in captivity. So we wanted to find out, why are there so many tigers in the United States? How did this happen? Is there any criminality, wildlife trafficking going on. Again, the big why. And the reason this is happening is tourism. This tiger industry is driven by roadside zoos that have a constant supply of young cubs for tourists to come and pet and take selfies and be photographed with. So it's tourists petting and posing with these young cubs that's driving this industry.
You say there's between 5 and 10,000 tigers in the U.S. How come we don't know?
It's mind-boggling that we have such, you know, a broad estimate of how many tigers are out there. And the reason is that they're that poorly regulated. The USDA is the department that's in charge of captive wildlife that's either exhibited, bred, or used in laboratories. And there's a permitting process required for that. Other than that, people can have tigers as pets, and it doesn't fall within the USDA purview. So depending on where you live, it may be illegal to own a tiger. It may be permissible with some kind of permit, almost like a dog license. In certain states, it changes county to county. And there are still four states that have no laws regulating big cat ownership.
What are the states?
Nevada, Oklahoma, Wisconsin, and North Carolina.
Say I wanted to get a tiger and I'm in one of these four states. What do I do?
If you wanted to buy a tiger, you could go to a breeder, which most likely would be a roadside zoo, and buy a tiger and take it home and put it in your backyard. And no one would even know it was there.
And so are a lot of these tigers the privately owned tigers? Literally, people might not know that, like, the neighbors have tigers.
That's exactly the case. And there's been many, many situations where there's been some kind of crisis, anything from a hurricane to a flood to a medical emergency in someone's home, something that brings first responders into a neighborhood or to a house. And there may be a tiger running loose, or there might be a tiger in a flimsy cage in the backyard, or a dozen tigers in the backyard that no one even knew about. I want to note that most of the tigers in the United States are not in private ownership. Most of them are in roadside zoos. There's a few that are in, you know, AZA-accredited zoos.
What would be the percentage in accredited zoos compared to the 5 to 10,000?
Under 300. This problem is driven by roadside zoos that are breeding and discarding cubs when they become too big and dangerous to pet. There still are a lot of people that have them in private ownership, but it's a much smaller percentage. This is a fascinating fact. You can apply for a USDA exhibitor's license for a gerbil. And then once you have that license, you can get any animal you want, and you won't have to add those animals to your inventory until your license comes up for renewal again. So on your next year's inventory, you know, you can add the fact that you've bought a dozen tigers since then.
Let's go back to you and Steve setting out to report on this story. You went into this tiger underworld. How did that play out in terms of your investigation?
First off, I thought I was doing an animal story when I started reporting this. It turned out I was largely doing a crime story. There were a wide range of issues we discovered, anything from serious animal abuse, disposing of animals in many, many ways, wildlife trafficking, you know, use of tiger parts in products for sale, and a great deal of criminality. So when we began, we went on what is currently the largest rescue of tigers in U.S. history in January of 2017. People from an animal sanctuary in Arkansas, Turpentine Creek Wildlife Center, were taking over one of the biggest breeder cub petters in the country at that time called Serenity Springs in Colorado. And they relocated 78 tigers to sanctuaries across the country. And we went with them on the last leg of that rescue.
Why were they taking over?
The man had health problems and he decided to go out of business. Serenity Springs had been cited for years of egregious violations. A worker had had their arm ripped off by a tiger there. There were very serious issues there. And when they arrived, they found the most despicable situation that you can possibly imagine. It was like shin-deep in excrement. There were dead birds floating in the swimming pools that were supposed to be there for tigers to cool off in hot weather, bones and debris in every yard. And the animals were so inbred that most of them had very serious health problems, from warped spines to crossed eyes to injuries from fighting with other tigers. This was a horror show. And then from there, I got a grant from the National Geographic Society to begin work on this with Steve. And we at first traveled to roadside zoos as tourists, paying tourists, and went in, mostly fact-finding. You know, some places you're not allowed to photograph. You have to pay for the photographs. It's part of how they make money. At times, it was scary. You know, many of these venues are in very rural places. Some of them are in open carry states, and we're undercover in places that have threatening signs all over the place about animal rights people. They often call them animal rights terrorists.
So you went and you followed these tigers for the move. Then you go in and you start exploring all the roadside zoos. And then how do you, like with the Joe Exotic story, how does all that start taking place? And will you tell us a little bit about it?
Selfies, you know, with cubs are a big part of the advertising. The videos go viral. Videos of like a tiger cub with a chimpanzee, you know, pictures of people snuggling these adorable cubs that really are adorable. I see why people would want to do this. It's an amazing experience. But if people understood the dark underbelly to this industry, the abuse, killing tigers, disposing of tigers, you know, speed bred, taken from their mothers at birth, bad breeding, health issues, no vet care. People would not do this. So I was following a lot of this on Facebook and talking to people at many nonprofits, some of whom have been looking into this for decades. The Humane Society has done amazing legal work and amazing undercover work. PETA has done incredible investigations into this, and again, some really important lawsuits. So there are some incredible experts out there that I was consulting with. All of these people were, you know, directing me to who the biggest players in this were, who were the biggest breeders, who ran the largest cub petting operations. So obviously, Joe Exotic came onto the radar quite early because his true name, Joseph Maldonado Passage, his parents started Winnie Wood Zoo in 1999. And he started cub petting. He very quickly then started booking himself out to do cub petting opportunities at malls. And he turned this into a huge money-making business. There was a woman who started exposing his activities, Carol Baskin, who's the founder of Big Cat Rescue in Florida. She started putting it out there to the animal welfare community and the general public that petting cubs, dragging them to malls, handling them from the time their eyes were not yet open, no vaccines, not allowed to sleep. This was, she said, abusive. And suddenly, there were protests, people started boycotting the mall shows, and malls stopped booking Joe. Joe started publicly threatening her in many ways, on the internet, on a low-budget TV show he broadcast online from his zoo called Joe Exotic TV. Some of them were quite brutal. In one episode, he set up a dummy that looked like Carol Baskin, and he threatened the dummy and then blew its head off with a revolver.
On his show?
On his show. Wow. Then there was a point where it got really dangerous. He hired first a zoo employee to kill Carol, gave him a deposit. He didn't deliver. So he went after a second murder-for-hire person, and this time it was an undercover FBI agent. Joe was arrested on 2 counts of murder for hire and an additional 19 wildlife charges in September of 2018. Testimony in that trial revealed that across this industry, people regularly falsify documents to illegally sell tigers across state lines. And it was a really important thing to put on the public record because there is so much wildlife trafficking in this industry. And what's illegal since 2016 is selling an endangered species across state lines. His trial was in March of this year, and he was convicted on both counts of murder for hire and 17 wildlife charges, including killing 5 tigers to make room for other tigers at his venue. Part of it was a murder for hire trial, but it felt like a murder trial when they were talking about how those 5 tigers were killed at Wynnewood Wildlife Park. Under oath, former employee Dylan West described what happened. That was back in October 2017. And Joe tranquilized 5 tigers and, quote, walked up to them with the .410 rifle and put it against their heads and pulled the trigger. And then West hauled them away in a bucket loader and buried them in the zoo's trash dump. On the stand, Joe defended himself, saying that the law was written for wild animals, not those born in zoos. The thing that this trial revealed was that extra tigers are disposed of to make room for the next batch. That was really, really important information to get in sworn testimony.
It also makes sense when people's numbers aren't going up, but they have cubs every 2 months, 3 months, new cubs.
Because Joe Exotic is such a colorful character, I think a lot of people have focused on him and his personal story. However, it's not just one person who's involved in this. I worked closely with the National Geographic data team, and we pulled in whatever records were in existence from 2 different breeders, Joe Exotic and Serenity Springs. And we put together a data map showing trades in and out of those facilities. And there were trades all over the country. This isn't just a small isolated thing with a couple of people. This is a nationwide industry. The various government agencies have misstepped in ways that have allowed tigers to breed out of control in this country.
So Joe is in jail.
Joe is in jail. He's not yet been sentenced. However, his partner is still running Wynnewood Wildlife Park, and he is currently building a new, larger facility further south in Oklahoma that I believe will be called Oz, the Oklahoma Zoo, and it will be a breeding, cub petting, hands-on with wildlife zoo.
I'm really curious about this connection between roadside zoos and the criminal world. Will you talk a little more about the connection between the two?
Traditionally, wildlife trade has been looked at as an environmental issue. It's not. In most countries, and especially in Asia and Africa, it's organized crime. You know, trafficking wildlife is a low-risk, high-profit industry. Even if you get caught, the penalties are really low. And you make a lot of money. Just to give you a sense, some of the venues I visited, it cost anywhere from $130 to $700 per person to have contact with these animals. The $130 or $140 was at the Zoological Wildlife Foundation in Miami. That was for 5 minutes per person with a cub. So the amount of money to be made is huge.
Were you shocked by that? That shocks me.
Absolutely. A common thread that I found amongst every one of these cub petting venues is that all of them claim to be saving tigers. They all justify what they're doing in the name of conservation, and it's completely unfounded. First and foremost, these animals are inbred. They're crossbred between species, often like Bengal, Siberian, maybe something else thrown in there, and they're really not well. So you know, they have no contribution to the genetics of tigers to keep them alive. And secondly, there has never been a successful introduction of a captive bred tiger back into the wild. Because if they're used to people, then they hang around villages, they kill livestock, they're dangerous to humans. So these roadside zoos are not contributing in any way to conservation.
No, so they're not really contributing to anything except tourism.
What it is, they're tourist venues that make a great deal of money.
In your story, you also mention someone who was caught sending tiger parts back to Asia from here.
Yes. So this man, Mr. Malasukum, whose nickname was Paul, couldn't buy these tiger parts at an auction in Texas because he wasn't a resident. So he hired these two buyers who were undercover U.S. Fish and Wildlife agents, and they bought and shipped those items to him. He then shipped those items in two separate packages, along with lion parts, elephant tusks, and other wildlife parts to Thailand. And when he was arrested, he admitted to having shipped 68 packages of wildlife parts to Thailand over the previous, I believe, 16 months. He was arrested in 2016, and he was convicted and served 9 months in prison.
And there's no way to know how much of that is happening either.
The largest demand for tiger products comes from China. The most coveted and expensive products are tiger skins, which are used for luxury home decor.
Like furniture?
Furniture hung on a wall, yes. And tiger bone wine. Tiger bone wine is a highly coveted elixir that is made by soaking a tiger skeleton in rice wine. Depending on how long it's soaked, the vintage, it can be worth a tremendous amount of money, to the point where there are some investors in China that are literally buying up vintage tiger bone wine, tiger parts, and banking on extinction using it as a long-term investment. Tiger products have become luxury products in China. It's a way to flaunt prestige and wealth. Displaying a tiger skin, serving tiger bone wine, maybe serving tiger meat at a dinner party.
Oh, so people serve it like to drink.
Yes. This is a luxury trade. This is not a middle class product.
And China, they breed a lot of tigers in captivity as well. Is that correct?
In China, there are currently about 6,000 tigers in tiger farms where tigers are literally farmed for their parts. This is a commercial business. In the U.S., it's also a commercial business. You know, tigers are speed bred for cubs for the petting industry. And speed breeding means that cubs are whisked away from their mother at birth. And it's this never-ending cycle.
These cubs get older and they're going somewhere, right? Or they're going nowhere. They're being killed. But for the ones that do survive and are around past 3-4 months, what then is the rest of their life like?
Many of these tigers have serious health problems. You know, not only have they not received proper nutrition, which often means metabolic bone disease. I've seen x-rays of tigers where their bones were so poorly formed that they literally looked like a mosaic instead of a solid bone. They weren't getting proper nutrition, calcium, vitamins to grow a skeleton properly. I've seen them with warped spines, so bad they almost looked like a camel or swayback. Many inbred tigers have serious crossed eyes, neurological problems. So off the bat, they're not getting vet care. And then they often live in very bleak circumstances with very poor care, small prison-like cages that are filthy. And it's just not a life for one of the most majestic animals on the planet, you know, the largest of the big cats.
No, it's devastating. And how does this stop? What do we do? What can people do? What needs to be done?
There's no overarching federal legislation regulating ownership of big cats. So right now, there's a bill that has been introduced into both houses of Congress, the Big Cat Public Safety Act, that would not only make it illegal to own a big cat as a pet owner in every state in the country, but it would also make it illegal to breed cats, tigers, lions, big cats, outside of species survival program international stud book breeding programs. The bill currently has 218 co-sponsors, so there's a lot of support for this bill. And I think a lot of the reason is that first responders across the country have stepped on board. Because when something goes wrong, when there's a natural disaster, you know, a flood, a hurricane, you know, cages get knocked down, you know, when somehow a tiger gets loose, who gets called? It's 911. You know, what do you do if you come into a neighborhood and there's a tiger running down the street?
Can you imagine just seeing tigers running down your street? Could you go back to the bill for a second and just explain the breeding part of it, what that means, the species survival program?
So accredited zoos across the world very carefully choose which Siberian tiger to breed to which Siberian tiger to hopefully keep genetic viability for the species.
Well, and currently people are doing much more than just inbreeding different species of tigers. Will you talk about ligons and I don't even know what they're called. Ligers and tigons.
There's some breeders, including Myrtle Beach Tiger Safari, you know, Wynnewood Animal Park, that breed lions and tigers. It's something that never happens in nature. Depending on which one is the father and which one is the mother, they either then become ligers or tigons. And then depending on what they're then bred back to, they can become a liliger or a liliger or a tigon.
And this whole population of liligers and tigons only really exists in roadside zoos.
Ligers, tigons, and other hybrids are human-created freaks of nature. They do not exist in the wild. All of them have health issues. Ligers grow to enormous size. I saw a 900-pound liger named Hercules at Myrtle Beach Safari. Its head was massive. It had weird stripes. It didn't look like a tiger or a lion. It was some netherworld of a monstrous cat. Its head, you know, went up to a tall man's chin. And all of them grow to that size. Ligers grow to massive size because lions receive a growth-regulating gene from their mom. So if it's a tiger mother, they don't get that. So they don't stop growing at the size a lion would stop growing, I mean, or a tiger.
It's just creepy.
It's kind of Isle of Dr. Moreau.
And they just do this to exhibit them, to show tourists.
Having these odd animals attracts tourists.
How does the tourism side of all of this shift? Is it getting people to stop going? Because it doesn't seem like you're going to be able to, we're going to be able to stop people from exhibiting.
If you can have hands-on contact with a wild animal, there is most likely a very dark underbelly to what's going on with those animals. There's many people that go to venues like this. They hear that they're contributing to conservation. They believe that the money they paid to get in goes towards protecting wild tigers. So they happily post their selfies on Facebook and Instagram and go home feeling good about themselves, because they think they've done something good in the world. And let's face it, handling a tiger cub is a magical experience because they're gorgeous. They're amazing. But if those same people knew the kind of abuse that was behind this industry and the criminality, I really don't think parents would be bringing their children there. I think public perception will really begin to change. But in order for this to change, action has to be twofold. And it's not only consumer responsibility, but it's also government regulation, which is lacking. On top of that, there needs to be oversight by USDA of captive animal facilities. That's one thing that really surprised me. I only discovered very late in our investigation that USDA was purposefully not enforcing the Animal Welfare Act. From 2016 to 2018, investigations into violators dropped by 92%. On their website, USDA instructed its inspectors to talk to people about problems instead of citing them, calling them teachable moments. Now, keep in mind that a citation isn't even a fine. It's no deterrent.
Right. Well, the USDA, it's always been bad. And then when the Trump administration came in, the USDA, it just became non-existent in terms of any help for animals across the board.
Well, I think it's more egregious than that. I think they're very consciously shirking their congressionally mandated duty to protect animals and protect the public.
How does all of this connect? The U.S. tiger issue and the issue of the fact tigers are going to go extinct in the wild very soon at the rate they're going right now.
U.S. lack of action on what many are calling the U.S. tiger crisis has global implications. In 2007, CITES passed a decision that tigers should not be bred for their parts or products. China has continued to farm tigers since then. And when the U.S. tries to step in and have discussions with Chinese delegates about tiger farms, they're laughed at. Chinese delegates look at us and say, at least we know how many tigers we have. The important thing here is that the U.S. is giving China cover to continue farming tigers that feed a growing demand. And that demand puts every last tiger in the crosshairs. And poaching is one of the two largest threats facing wild tigers today. And again, just for context, at the turn of the 20th century, when Rudyard Kipling penned The Jungle Book, there were about 100,000 tigers left in the wild. Today, there are perhaps 4,000.
And once we get down to certain numbers, is there a no turning back point? Does that mean they're on their way to extinction? Or is it possible to turn all of these around?
The good news is that tigers breed like cats. Given protection and enough habitat and enough prey to eat, they bounce back. There are situations where really great protection have really made a difference. And there are some parts of India that's true. Hoi Khai Kang National Park in northern Thailand, their tigers are bouncing back. They haven't had a tiger killed by a poacher in 4 years because of a military-style enforcement.
That's what it's going to take in a lot of these parks.
Yes. You know, as long as tigers are worth as much money as they are on the international market, they're in danger.
So while you were reporting the story, were there moments where it felt like you were in real danger?
We were with a family that was petting a cub in a living room on a couch at the Ringling Animal Care Center in Oklahoma. There was a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old kid, each of them, you know, given the cub a bottle. It was about a 12-week-old cub. When it finished its bottle, it got bored, jumped on the coffee table, and then started attacking our photo equipment. And then it jumped off, ran behind me, and stood on its hind legs, grabbed me from behind, ripped 5-inch scratches into my thighs, and dug its claws in and held on. Thankfully, you know, the owner came and peeled it off of me very quickly, but it was a really important, informative experience because I learned how strong and how dangerous these animals are at the age of 3 months old. Steve was photographing in another place in Oklahoma, a private owner, Lori Ensign Scroggins in Broken Arrow. She has probably close to 30 tigers and lions. She used to be open to the public, but a volunteer was killed by one of her ligers. She still owns hundreds of animals of all species, and she has a Thai tigon. The animal has such serious health issues. It has terrible vision, crossed eyes, almost blind. She walks it on a leash and brings it in her home. So we're walking around with this Thai tigon as she's making her daily rounds of the zoo. And Steve made the mistake of squatting down to photograph the animal at eye level, which made him prey. The animal, whose name is Langley, charged him. The animal leaped three times, jumping him. Steve managed to just kind of turn his back, and somehow Langley just stopped. But this was a 280-pound animal, and I'm very thankful that Steve's instincts, contrary to what you think he should do, he turned his back. And it's really great that he did, because if he had been facing the animal head on, he could have had his arm ripped off.
That is so terrifying.
I truly think he wanted to play, because if he really wanted to hurt Steve, Steve would be dead.
Absolutely. Oh, for sure. It's confusing to me, and I'm sure to a lot of people, this whole world of sanctuary, zoo. I know there's specific regulations on what's a sanctuary, what's a zoo, but the lines seem to get really blurred. Can you talk about that a little bit?
The Association of Zoos and Aquariums are the larger zoos that we, you know, tend to think of. The Zoological Association of America is another member organization. The difference between the two is that the AZA does not allow hands-on contact with wildlife, and the ZAA allows breeding and hands-on contact. There's many, many zoos that have no accreditation at all.
I think to wrap this up, for someone like you who has spent so much time all over the world and with seeing tigers in their natural environment in the wild and their beauty and their majesty and just how they move and walk and stalk and, you know, slink around. And I mean, they're absolutely stunning and spectacular creatures. So to go from that kind of reporting that you were doing and stories on those tigers to then these tigers in these terrible, crappy conditions where they're turning them into Frankenstein kind of monsters of weird breeding and kept in small cages. It's heartbreaking across the board. But for you, how did this feel?
Sometimes after a long day at a venue that kept tigers under really inhumane conditions, reeking filthy enclosures, the animals, they stumbled around, warped spines, skinny or morbidly obese, small enclosures. And I'd come back dusty and sweaty, you know, to a hotel, and I would literally put my head in my hands. There were times I cried. It just gets to you. You have to keep the mission and the goal in mind, which for me, the goal is to save the last of the wild tigers. And in the process, hopefully alleviate some very serious suffering by these caged tigers. But I have my eye on the long goal. I really want to see tigers exist for future generations. I have a new granddaughter. Her name is Winter Rose Ruggia. She's 9 months old, and I want her to live in a world where there's still beauty, where there still is healthy wildlife, where we still have functioning ecosystems. And that's why I do this work.
I think this story in December's issue of National Geographic has power to start changing things in this country and changing things, period.
Stories like this can be a spark in the world. But action only comes, change only comes when other people step in.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you for your work, for your story, and for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about Sharon and her work, go to her website. It's sharongynup.com. G-U-Y-N-U-P. We will have links to her work on our website, speciesunite.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you'd like to support the podcast, which we would greatly appreciate, you can do so one of two ways. You can subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. Please do. And we're also on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. Thank you for listening. I'd like to thank everyone who made today's episode possible, including Gary Knutson, Natalie Martin, Allison Berenger, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thanks again. Have a wonderful day.